forum for frank talk about what people do for a living. Works Do.
Hello and welcome to Work Stew. It's February 21st, 2011, and this is episode number 2. I'm Kate Gace Walton. I'm the editor of WorkStew.com, an online collection of essays in which people ponder their work lives. Today I'll be interviewing Mark Britton, the founder and CEO of Avvo.com and an entrepreneur who's been named one of Seattle's top 25 innovators. No small feat in a city of dynamic startups. Going forward, I'd like to keep these shows to about 30 minutes long, so we'll go pretty much straight to the interview today. But I do want to thank those of you who listened to the last show, and especially those of you who took the time to share your reactions. Putting your first podcast out there is sort of a leap of faith, and it was incredibly encouraging to hear feedback from listeners. Ned Minoyo of California wrote that he loved what investigative reporter Gretchen Peters said about it being important to learn what you don't like in your work and to know that you have the power to change things if it's not working out for you. My hope for WorkStew was that the occasional gem would resonate in a way that someone might find useful, and it was exciting to hear that that's already starting to happen. Please keep writing in. In future episodes, I'll share as many listener comments as I can. And now, the interview. Today I'm talking with Mark Britton, the founder, CEO, and president of Avvo, A-V-V-O, an online service that helps people choose lawyers and doctors by providing ratings and a forum for reviews. As a passionate advocate for consumers, Mark is a frequent television commentator. I'm very glad that he's agreed to add Work Stew to his extensive media resume, and I want to start, Mark, by thanking you for making the time to talk today.
Yeah, no problem, Kate. You're being very entrepreneurial here with the things you're doing, so I'm happy to help.
So before we dig into your experiences since launching Avvo, which I gather was in 2006, you went to law school. What motivated you to go to law school in the first place, and what did you end up doing right after you graduated?
So, you know, I come out of Western Montana, where still, I think, most people don't grow up and say, you know, you should really be a software engineer. You should be a doctor or lawyer. And not surprising, so I have two siblings. I'm the mixed up middle child. But my older brother's a doctor. I'm a lawyer. My sister's a teacher. And those are very traditional roles. Interestingly, none of us live in Montana anymore. Really, you know, I grew up in a family of lawyers. My mother's a lawyer. I have an uncle who's a judge. I have an aunt. It just goes on and on. And I married a lawyer. So it's just been this area that I always understood. I was around it a lot. And I can remember chatting with my mom about what I might do after leaving college. I had a finance degree and I loved finance. But again, you know, law was one of those areas that was so easy to see the opportunity, whereas finance, that meant moving out to the East Coast or what have you, which I ended up doing after law school, but took really the family path in legal. And, you know, ultimately, it served me very well. So I joined a big firm here in Seattle, Preston Gates and Ellis, which was, it's now K&L Gates. I'd done a large transaction with them, so I knew them, I felt comfortable with them, and I joined them, but not surprisingly, they had a lot of Microsoft work, and I worked on a lot of Microsoft transactions and got to know a guy named Greg Stanger, who ran corporate development for Microsoft. I got to know him quite well, and that's where the whole Expedia, Greg and I did a couple of deals together. Greg ended up being the CFO of Expedia, and as all of that was starting to take shape, Greg asked if I'd like to come be the general counsel to be Expedia's first general counsel and build their legal and government affairs teams from scratch.
So when you made that decision, were you at this point sort of already captivated by the potential of the internet to provide consumers you know, choices like they had never had before? Or was that something that dawned on you the more time you spent within the halls of Expedia?
I think it was a couple of things. First of all, I always found my strength as a lawyer as being very strong in finance. And I don't know what it is about finance, but it's just something that always rings true to me. And I love to measure, you know, looking at value in companies and having bought and sold a lot of companies as part of being a kind of a corporate development, corporate securities lawyer. That's how, you know, that was one of my cores that made me unique. And as a consequence of Preston Gates, I worked on some really big multi-billion-dollar financial restructuring transactions, et cetera, stuff that you don't normally see in Seattle. And so one thing that I was really attracted in going to Expedia was I knew they were going to acquire a lot of companies. I knew I was dealing with one of the smartest financial people I knew, being Greg Stenger, and also his boss, who was the CFO of Microsoft and the chairman of Expedia, which was a guy named Greg Maffei. So working with them to develop Expedia from a business standpoint, that was really exciting. However, I had also been representing a lot of smaller companies in the web space, and I was thoroughly convinced by that point that where large data sets were involved, so travel, you know, there's all this data as it relates to travel, to the extent that you can capture it and editorialize it in some way and give consumers direct control, that those models were just going to blow the traditional models out of the water. And I was a very, very early Expedia user because my wife and I love to travel. And I loved, it was so liberating to be able to plan my trips and have all this data that before I had to go see a travel agent who, you know, sat with the green screen facing at her, that was kind of telling me where I had to travel and at what price. So when all of those pieces came together and Greg said, would you have any interest being our general counsel? It was hard because I had just made partner at Preston at a fairly young age in a big firm in Seattle. It's kind of everything you work towards. But from an interest standpoint and opportunity, but really that financial / business piece and the internet piece, I said, wow, I just can't pass this up.
Right. So at what point did you start to think, you know, I have entrepreneurial ambitions of my own? When did that come about?
You know, it goes way back. So I lived in Italy for a year in my junior year. There was an artist that named Bruno Sagatta that worked for Gonzaga University that I helped him sell his art here in the U.S. We turned one of his arts into a poster and sold it to students from my program. You know, it was that type of stuff where, you know, I come from a background where my dad was and is a very successful businessman. He's wound down considerably, but, you know, it was in the cattle business in Montana. And for generations, we've run, you know, my dad had a trucking company and he had a feedlot and he had, you know, these different businesses that he put together. And on my mom's side, you know, they had their own restaurant for all the time that I grew up. And so watching them employ themselves was always very attractive to me. That there was that element of it, but I never felt in law that I, especially in a big firm, that I could get that complete control. And so I think there was a very strong entrepreneurial element that I had observed. I found that there were some really easy, fun ways in college that I could make money, try new things, et cetera, but ultimately went down a fairly safe path by being a lawyer and never felt like I could scratch that itch as much as I wanted to unless I started my own firm at some point. Or I left the law firm environment and joined a company so I could exercise my business / strategic legs, which is ultimately what I did.
Right. So then how did the idea of Avo come about? Was there a light bulb moment? Did it emerge over time?
Well, it's both. And I really think that anybody who speaks to a light bulb moment, it's still the result of a lot of data that's being taken in over the years. And so just to, let me give you the light bulb moment and maybe give you a bit of background. Let me flip that around. I'll give you the background. So for one thing that we really noticed when I was running the legal team at Expedia was that when we needed a lawyer outside of my network or my team's network, it was really hard. So just one example that sticks out is we needed a lawyer in Biloxi, Mississippi. Crews had pulled in there. Somebody had slipped. They were suing us in, they slipped on the cruise. They were suing us for damages in Biloxi, Mississippi, and needed to find a lawyer fairly quickly. The closest I could get through my network was Atlanta or maybe someplace in Florida. And we ended up using a connection of a connection of a connection. And the guy did a great job. It was all word of mouth, took a long time. But I remember thinking back then, and this is early on in Expedia, and you know, this is late 90s, me thinking, you know, how does your average person find a lawyer in Biloxi, Mississippi if they need to? And so it was little things like that where I just always noticed that when it came to lawyers, you had to be a lawyer and work through that word of mouth in order to have any meaningful success. Where the light bulb really went off is through the years, anyone who is a lawyer or a doctor or tend to have a very specialized area that they practice in, they'll always talk about being at parties or in a public situation, and someone will find out that they're a doctor or a lawyer, and people will want to get their advice on the spot. And it's just this weird thing, which some people resent it, some people love it. But I every time I would tell somebody I was a lawyer, they would say, oh, you know, I have this legal question.
Right.
And, you know, do you have any idea what I would do here? And they're talking about, like, you know, the kennel that's encroaching from their neighbors. And I'm thinking, listen, I buy and sell companies. That's kind of what I've done as a lawyer, help them raise money. And so still the little amount of knowledge I would have about easements or real property law was so much more than they could even begin with. So I get them pointed in the right direction, might recommend a couple of lawyers. And really, I think most lawyers and doctors, accountants, insurance agents, they have a free service that they do on the side for friends and family, where they're getting them pointed in the right direction and referring business to friends. So I went off after Expedia and I taught finance in Italy for a year. And so I was gone for a year. You know, you have the Atlantic Ocean in between me and most of my friends. And, you know, I'm teaching finance. I'm not even teaching law. But one thing that really struck me was that I was still getting questions, a lot of questions related to legal issues. I had a friend who was starting a company, I had a friend who was going through divorce, and they're contacting me about their legal issues, trying to get pointed in the right direction. And I remember just thinking, why, you know, I was in travel for so many years, nobody calls and asks me about travel. So what is this unique thing about legal or medical or anything else? And I knew inherently from my own research when I told you about our Biloxi, Mississippi case that there just weren't resources out there for consumers. So I did more research, and one of the first pieces of data we came across was this idea that lawyers were spending over $1 billion in the Yellow Pages still at that time, with consumers doing, at least the Yellow Pages claimed, about 200 million lookups for legal-related issues. And it's about half of that on each side for medical. And so I was just looking at these gargantuan numbers and saying, anytime that the Yellow Pages is a primary informational resource for consumers, something's wrong. And so I'm not sure I needed to do another piece of research as it related to the market to know that there was a huge opportunity and the existing participants were not serving the consumer well. And it was tearing a page out of the Expedia playbook in a lot of ways and democratizing a lot of information and giving consumers control over their legal and now medical decisions.
Right. So that after you launched, and I know I'm skipping a few steps here, because that in itself involved securing funding. I saw you were funded by Benchmark. But once you were launched, how did the legal community react? In some ways, I would think you must have looked like someone who had kind of stepped out of the clubhouse and was making waves.
I think it depends. I think for your internet savvy lawyers, they were, so many people said, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing I think I've ever seen. And one thing to keep in mind, our touchstone is the consumer. And so from a consumer standpoint, consumers who are used to using sites like Yelp or City Search or what have you, they look at something like Avvo as it relates to lawyers and just lawyers back then, but across any professional services, and they go, oh my God, this is exactly what I wanted. If I had to hire a lawyer, now that I'm hiring a lawyer, this is exactly the type of information I need. And that's where the validation is. But still, we are a marketplace, and we're trying to, we do introduce potential clients, potential patients, and doctors and lawyers. So it's critical that they find value in that as well, and that they think it is legitimate, et cetera. But the thing you must keep in mind is we as consumers are getting so tired of those sites where the quote-unquote recommended doctor, lawyer, what have you, is the one that pays the most amount of money to advertise. And we were just ripping that out of the system. And it is just a virus when it comes to professional services. No truly consumer-centric sites out there. They tend to be more of the Yellow Pages model, just a shill for lead generation. So when we came out, I think those lawyers who understand where the web is evolving and the consumer desire to have this information, I think they just loved it. They were holding the future. Then you have a huge part of the population that's indifferent, right?
Right.
Like, if it works out, whatever, I'll participate later. And then you have a large part of the population that is saying, or not large, a small part of the population that is saying, we want to put this to bed. So we were sued 9 days after we launched in a proposed class action by a local attorney here. And, we've been sued 3 times. And every time we are sued, we're sued by a lawyer that has misconduct in our background, because as part of our consumer centricity, we disclose whether attorneys have misconduct in their background, and we rate them poorly if they do. So we rate from 1, which is extreme caution, all the way up to 10, which is superb. And every rating system prior to us was everybody was a super lawyer, a best lawyer, what have you. No one was willing to put their foot down and say, no, in our opinion, this lawyer should be rated extreme caution. And that obviously got some lawyers very upset. But we run a sophisticated and responsible system, and judges have consistently seen that, and it hasn't been an issue from a litigation standpoint. But it is an issue from those lawyers going out and spreading a bunch of misinformation regarding what we do and how we do it. And that's a big part of my job is countering some of that negative thud.
And was your experience when you launched the doctor section of the site very similar? Was there still a small slice of the population objecting, or was it a very different experience?
Very different experience. I mean, we're still in the middle of it, right? We only launched doctors on November 1st, and it's kind of a month you lose in there because of the holidays as far as adoption goes. But so one thing that we still we're always trying to convince big law firms that, so again, we're very consumer centric, and we're about helping those consumer driven areas like family law, criminal, personal injury, a lot of the Yellow Pages categories, the small business, real estate, helping those consumers get in front of the right lawyer, because big corporations don't need as much help. General counsels don't need as much help. so a lot of big firms say, well, I principally deal with a general counsel, the lead lawyer, who are very sophisticated purchasers of legal services. So the idea that I need to get in there and answer questions in AVO or what have you, it's just not, there's a lower ROI. They don't necessarily speak in those words, but that's what their actions are saying. We've had the exact, and the good news is, I mean, if you think in, we have a lot of the big firms that are coming around as their younger partners are starting to understand social media and just web interaction in general. We have law firms, huge law firms all over the country that have claimed for every single lawyer. But it's still, it takes more convincing than it does the individual lawyers. And when we launched medical, I think part of it was our traction in legal. But we have had all of these big hospitals come out of the woodwork and say, we've seen what you did in legal, and we would like to partner with you early on. So if you take Seattle, where we are, you're talking about Swedish and Northwest and Evergreen and Polyclinic and all these big names who have signed up every one of their doctors for our service, and we have an advertising partnership with them now. And so we're quickly building our product to make sure that it's responsive to those big organizations in a way that we're still working on that in legal. And then so we also haven't had as much immediate backlash from individual doctors. We've had some complaints, but I think the big difference is when we launched in the summer of 2007, rating someone's services was still unique, whereas since we've launched that, you have a number of sites that are attempting to do this for doctors, and so they're a bit more sensitized to it. Although there's a lot of confusion around people assuming that we're just ratings from patients, when we do have the editorial AVO rating in addition to those patient ratings, which makes us quite unique. So there's a marketing challenge there to get unlumped from the people who've stormed this market over the last couple of years. But anyway, as just kind of a summary on all of that, I think it's been an easier launch from a friction standpoint, but friction also drives a lot of marketing. I mean, getting sued in that class action, we knew we were on stable ground, and anytime you can get sued on stable ground, it can be great for a nascent company because it drives just a tremendous amount of press for them. And I mean, we ended up having the Wall Street Journal endorse us, you know, huge article in the New York Times, what have you. We never would have gotten that kind of press had lawyers not come after us.
Right. So you mentioned that in most cases, the people that did come after you had disciplinary records that obviously they didn't want to see come to light. More broadly, though, in your population of lawyers and doctors, do you see any legitimate concerns that they might have in terms of how, you know, your service is executed? And are there any things that you've done to address those kinds of concerns? Like, how does one balance the rights to, you know, free speech on the one hand, and then rights to be protected from defamation or libel? How have you addressed that?
So it's kind of a loaded question because, I would start out by saying that I say your question's loaded because it assumes that a lot of those things are issues, and we would have to dig. I'd almost want to peel back a layer to understand exactly what you're saying, but let me give a fairly broad approach and then maybe we can peel back some stuff. The key anytime that you are doing something new and different, some people aren't going to like it, right? Because it's still part of that evolution. The key as a company is to make sure that you're listening and reacting very quickly. We make mistakes. We do things that are just boneheaded sometimes where, from a business perspective, I think, well, what were we thinking? Why did we think that was a good idea? And the key is to listen to your community and roll it back quickly. I think lawyers and doctors across the nation, especially with lawyers having built a relationship with them over the last three, four years, you know, they really believe that, well, they may not agree with everything that we do, that we're working with the legal community, and when there are things that are potentially unfair, we are we take corrective action. And let me give you a great example in this regard. Anytime you're dealing with someone's professional reputation, I think that you have an increased level of responsibility. And by that, particularly as it relates to client or patient reviews, and that you got to put some money against this. So there are companies out there that will accept reviews as it relates to a professional, but they don't really have a system as it relates to curating or otherwise dealing with those reviews. And we put together a system that really is the gold standard. I don't think there's anyone that is putting as many resources against this as we are. So just a couple of quick examples. We have community guidelines, which are very strict. You must be factual, no personal attacks, no swearing, that sort of stuff. And we reject right around a third of our reviews that we receive every single month because they don't meet our community guidelines. And that would just be heresy for some companies because they want that extra third of content is so valuable for them on so many levels. But they're also destroying their marketplace in a lot of ways because they're letting a lot of junk get in. The other thing we do is we have a great proprietary computer system that looks at reviews, looks for red flags on reviews before they go out. And then we have a human that looks at every single review before it goes up on the site. Every single review. Looking at the terms of use and also looking if the computer has flagged something. But every single one. Then it goes up, and if a professional comes to us and tells us that a review does not look correct for whatever reason, we take the review down, and then we have a process whereby we... I missed a very important point. We require everyone who leaves the review to register with us. So we don't have any anonymous reviews. Now, we may not disclose the person's name, but we know who they are. And so when a professional, when a physician or a lawyer comes to us and says, you know, I don't believe that I can't, you know, in my EMR, my medical records, I can't find anyone who fits this. It doesn't feel right. I feel like it might be a competitor, whatever may be the concern, comes down. We go back because we have the contact information for the person, and if they don't respond, the review stays down. If they, you know, what happens a lot is people say, you know, I was pretty upset when I wrote that, and we're almost always, by the way, talking about a negative review. And I was a little hot when I wrote that. Can I modify it? We'll let them modify it in that situation. Or a lot of times people will come back and say, listen, I'm real. I said what I meant. And we let the review stand. So even if we leave the review to stand, however, the lawyer or the doctor has a place to comment on that review right under the review in the site. So right there, I'm constantly counseling professionals on to not fear the negative review because I try to get their brain going on how they shop for goods and services, and everybody says, well, yeah, if I only see positive reviews, that makes me a little worried. So I see a negative review here and there. I tend to throw them out as outliers. But if there were a legitimate review there and you could see the professional engaging and saying, hey, from my records, I believe that we worked exactly according to plan, you know, just handling it professionally and speaking to it without disclosing anything that's, you know, that would violate HIPAA or anything else, just being very professional and saying, hey, I do great work, and I believe that I handled your case professionally and well, and why don't you get a hold of me and we can talk about it more? That goes miles. So all of these safeguards and giving everyone their say is part of our process. It's very expensive, but it's part of that commitment that we have to ensure that we're delivering this sophisticated and responsible service that balances those issues that I think you were getting at.
Well, thank you so much. It's an interesting path that you've taken, and I appreciate your walking us through it. Really enjoyed hearing about it, and I appreciate your time.
Well, you're welcome. It's an interesting path you're taking as well, Kate. So good luck on your writing. And it was just a great interview. I really appreciate it.
That wraps up the show for today. Thanks very much again to my guest, Mark Britton. Also, Chris Walton, my husband and collaborator. This podcast would not be possible without his technical expertise. Thanks also to everyone who has contributed an essay to WorkStew, and many thanks to those who are currently working on essays of their own. Finally, thanks very much to you for listening today. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll check it out. In the meantime, please let me know what you thought of the show by sending an email to kate@workstew.com, or by posting a comment on the WorkStew website, or in a few weeks when we are live on their directory, by writing a review for iTunes. Thanks again, and bye for now.